Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly, bringing you politics without the boring bits. It's the best bits of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download your Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, lovely end of week listening. The British Film Institute have opened up their archive to us, so they don't do it very often. Taking a look at some of the political content they've got. Party political broadcasts, interviews, election coverage. The sort of stuff that seemed very important at the time, but about 100 years worth of stuff, including some silent adverts, which will work really well on the pod. Anyway, that's coming up in just a moment. Political nerds, basically, you'll love it. We'll speak to Gabby Hinsliff and James Marriott in just a moment. But first, as we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learn that Alan Titchmarsh asks Keir Starmer the best questions.
Your mum was a great donkey person.
We learn that once you get Keir Starmer talking about donkeys...
My mum and dad had four children, and as we each left home, they replaced us with a donkey.
And there's just no stopping him.
They've obviously found the donkey for their nativity.
We learn what Rishi Sunak wants for Christmas.
What do you want for Christmas?
What do I want for Christmas?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I haven't really thought about that, actually. I'd like to have a day off.
We also learn what Rishi Sunak wants to be when he's grown up.
I wanted to be like a Star Wars character, like a Jedi Knight, or fly an X-Wing. Now, have you heard of an X-Wing?
No!
Okay, right, so an X-Wing is a special spaceship in Star Wars, and I want to fly one of those.
We learned from Tory MP Nick Fletcher that...
Doncaster is full.
And in the next breath, he had this message for Gary Lineker and rich lefty lawyers.
I asked them to sell everything that they've got. I asked them to give it all away. Then I asked them to come and get a job in Doncaster.
Even though...
Doncaster is full.
We learned for the first time what Einar Horn pushing the buttons sounds like on air. Some breaking news to bring you on Times Radio. Einar Horn is now here.
Morning.
Wow. He's live on the radio. Would you like to explain to the class why you weren't here for the beginning of the show?
Nope.
And we learned that Penny Morden is feeling festive about the SNP.
12 hours of police questioning, 11 grand roaming charges, 10 years without school inspections, 9 sham embassies, 8 years of poor child mental health, 7 years without ferries, 6 years shirking welfare powers, 500 million overspent on Edinburgh's tram, 4 million to install a heat pump, 3 high-profile arrests, 2 overseas jollies, and a dodgy Jaguar EV.
And that is what we learned this week. Now it's time for this.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor with my laptop frantically bashing away at my column.
Oh, is it time to drop that, we think, James Marriott?
Yeah, I'm over it.
I think the new year, clean slate.
Oh, God, I can't. Can we have me say... What about me say something really, like, interesting and funny and erudite?
Well, instead? If you did, we'd clip it up.
I say stuff like that all the time. I'm going to choose my own clip.
Okay, fine. Very good. Well, it's nice to see you anyway, Jase.
Yes, it's
good. No Indian Nights today, but we have got Gabby Hinsliff. Hello, Gabby.
Hello. Where Fortunately, I've never said anything embarrassing, so that's fine.
Where in the world are you this morning, Gabby?
I'm in rural Oxfordshire, where snowing, disappointingly.
Now, the last time you were on, we were talking a lot about Boris Johnson and his neighbours and all of that, because you're not far from him. What's the mood now?
We're bored with Boris Johnson. Our new local celebrity is Jason Donovan, who has a house in Oxfordshire and has told Waitrose magazine that he's spending Christmas here. So that's it. No one cares about Boris Johnson.
Excellent. Good to have those live updates. Now, here's a thought. Rishi Sunak has obviously had a tough week.
like every week. But, you know, getting into Amanda Bill Thew, and everyone was talking about that. And I just wondered whether actually the big sort of political event of the week for him in the long term might be that he's off to this gathering in Rome this weekend. It's a political gathering hosted by the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, joining a lineup of speakers including Elon Musk and Santiago Abascal, who's the head of this of Spain's hard-right Vox party. And actually, in terms of him getting any progress on stopping the number of people arriving into Europe and travelling through Europe and then trying to come to the UK, you know, it might mean sidling up to some quite right-wing people, but, you know, actually re-engaging with European leaders might be more successful, Gabby.
The guest list does sound like the kind of worst work Christmas party ever. But beyond that, I mean, I think it's a question of perhaps of who wants to hang out with Rishi Sunak now and who has common interests with us. And increasingly in Europe, he seems to have decided that's countries preoccupied with immigration. So, you know, the Italians, we're spending a lot of time with, you know, rather less time with Macron, who, of course, is the key to actually controlling immigration from across the channel. It's a question of making your friends where you can find them, almost, it feels now.
And actually, I suppose, James, because of the rise of far-right parties across Europe, to some extent, it's like, well, you've got to work with what you've got.
Yeah, who else are you going to hang out with? And I guess, you know, it's always that kind of Every politician in a crisis likes to go onto the world stage and look a bit like a statesman. Whether hanging out with Giorgia Meloni makes you look that much like a statesman might be another question. But it's always a kind of relief from the kind of hurly-burly of domestic politics, isn't it, to go around the world stage, stay in a nice hotel, go to a conference.
It's not always nice to go to a conference, stay in a nice hotel. Do you think you should be hanging out with Elon Musk so much, though?
Well, that's really weird. I mean, that was totally embarrassing the previous time with the interview that contravened all basic standards of journalism, where you have to actually ask people hard questions that aren't just, you know, softballs that they want to answer. I mean, from a wider perspective, obviously no. From a perspective of his personal, you know, plans for his career after politics in Silicon Valley, I suspect he probably should be hanging out with Elon Musk as much as he can, so he can, you know, have lots of contacts when he goes and works in the tech industry afterwards. It is, yeah, but from everyone else's perspective, it's so weird.
There was an interesting piece though in Matthew Paris wrote earlier in the week that he's bought a Starlink thing so he can get the internet in Derbyshire.
Oh yeah, and everybody in Derbyshire is using Starlink.
Yeah,
and everyone's using,
and I had no idea it was, because actually we're quite lucky where we are. Our internet's quite good.
That's one of those London biases, isn't it?
That yeah.
Everyone in the world apart from London is using Starlink apparently, and just never learn about it.
Instead
otherwise.
Of, you know, your BT dial-up. But he was sort of, Matthew was talking about feeling conflicted about, you know, it's brilliant, this internet, but they are buying it off a bloke who's a bit wild.
Yeah, and is now going to run, like, what? Our internet, our robots, our social media, it all feels
cars.
A bit... Cars.
Do you worry about all of that? What's your internet like where you are, Gabby?
I mean, obviously terrible, but preferable to Elon Musk's, I think, probably. I mean, that's the kind of... I feel like if we're going to hand over our entire future, you know, to some AI-enabled world where we're all replaced by robots, I kind of feel like I don't want Elon Musk to be in charge of it. I don't want someone whose cars catch fire and whose sort of, you know, big idea for AI is that we can all have a robot best friend in future. I'm not sure that these are the values that I particularly want in charge of the world. Some mad tech bro from California.
And the fact that Elon Musk's AI is the unwoke chatbot. Grok, which is
it's called
Grok, and it's trained on Twitter to not be woke because he thinks ChatGPT is woke. So right. Grok is supposed to be like offensive and edgy.
Right.
It's like if you've ever used Elon Musk's Twitter, you don't really want to live in Elon Musk's world, I feel.
Is it really called Grok?
Yeah.
It's quite close to Croc of, you know, Croc of, a word I can't repeat. Well, we'll come to that in a minute because we're going to talk about swearing.
Well, there's a column in that.
There's always a column in that. We'll come to your... Don't worry. We'll come to your column. We'll come to your column. Now, I want to talk about Martin Lewis. So the money-saving expert, Martin Lewis, is on the show yesterday. And we were talking about debt and the charity that he runs, which looks at the connection between money and mental health. And then we got on to, well, Christmas is coming and how do we make sure we don't get into a pickle financially this Christmas? And he ended up suggesting that we should stop buying Christmas presents for teachers to cut down on unnecessary gift giving.
I think we should ban. This is all about agreeing. So what I say is we should actually start and we should start in September and getting all those extended lists, and we should simply say, I think we shouldn't buy presents each year. I mean, if you want to, you can do the Secret Santa, some do, cap it at £5. Better, you can say, how about we give a donation to charity instead? Because charities are hurting this year. The lack of people's income is knocking through to a lot in the third sector. And actually, it's just that it's just filling Wake landfill. Now, teachers do an amazing job and they need, but perhaps, and I know many, many people now, a collective present from everybody in the class together.
But then this morning, Simon Kidwell, the national president of the National Association of Head Teachers, told Times Radio that he, you'll be surprised, he doesn't think there should be a ban.
If parents want to buy a teacher's gift, I think it's a wonderful gesture to say thank you, but no parent should ever feel pressure. I don't think we should have a blanket ban on it. I think parents should question, do they need to buy him a gift? Because parents, teachers certainly don't expect it.
Where do you stand on this one, Gabby?
I think he's just being polite there. I think most teachers would be really happy if you scrap press, because they're always rubbish, aren't they? I mean, they presumably get 30 mugs saying best teacher every year if you're a primary school teacher. I once asked a teacher friend, like, what was the best present, you know, that what do our teachers actually want? Because I was stumped. And she said, basically, there's only two good things. One is like a really heartfelt letter from your favorite child in the class explaining why you're their favorite teacher. No one ever doesn't like that. And the other one is a massive bottle of wine. And as I couldn't persuade my child to ever write a heart into the leader, their teacher, it was always wine. But other than that, I think teachers would be thrilled if they stopped having to pretend to be pleased about getting another tin of Quality Street.
But Martin was also talked about the sort of competitive gift-giving, and the you wouldn't want there to be the perception that teachers looked more favourably on the children who bought nicer presents.
No, I mean, there's a very... Sorry.
No, that was... Sorry, I was interrupting you. Sorry. I don't think teachers get nice enough presents to feel like they're... To feel like,
yeah, that's true. Because it is just a mug. It's a mug. It's a scented candle.
Well, actually, when you, as soon as you emailed me about this idea, I had a vivid memory of a guy called Alex in my class at school, who was a total dunce. I mean, really, not a bright kid. And his parents used to get give him the most extraordinary gifts for the teacher. And he once got our teacher, Mr. Russell. I remember this vividly as a child because I just thought, what on earth are you doing? A special expensive jelly bike seat. So like you could sit on your bike with this sort of special bike seat that was like jellified to protect your buttocks. And I was just remember thinking, this is the creepiest thing you could possibly have done, Alex, you total freak.
Are you still in touch?
No, not well. I mean, maybe we will be now because maybe he'll remember that.
8722, start your message with the word time if you want to get in touch.
But I just thought it was so weird.
And that is weird.
And he also was not a successful child, so if his grades bounced up because of this bike seat...
I really hope he's really successful now and he can get in touch and...
Yeah, well, he's sort of evidently maybe sliming his way up through the world banging up the bike seats. I was very sceptical about this as a child.
I didn't think that's where this conversation was going to go.
It's one of my vivid childhood memories, actually, sitting in the back of the class.
Yeah.
I was about 10.
Yeah.
Probably one of the teacher's vivid memories, let's face it, as well.
I know, it's a bit personal, isn't it?
Giving a jelly bike seat.
A bike seat.
Concerningly intimate, I would say.
That's very nicely put, Gabby. That's extraordinary, extraordinary. Let's move on and talk about swearing. Now, don't worry, I'm on standby. So I've got, should there be any need to, I can now control the bleep machine.
But can you, well, it's a kind of trigger test. Can you get to the button fast enough?
Well, we'll find out.
I'm going to try and beat you. I'm going to try and F and blind quicker than you can beat me.
But actually, the flaw in this is that we could just talk over it, so you're definitely going to be able to hear. Anyway, James, you've written about swearing. Let's talk about your love of swearing without swearing.
Words such as the F word,
yes,
or the B word, or the S word. No, I think it's actually possible to talk about love of swearing without swearing.
Go on.
I was just amused by the fact that there was some research allegedly carried out by an artificial intelligence machine, which had discovered there were 60,000 swear words broadcast on British television last year. And I was saying, you know, I guess the kind of standard response is, oh God, decline of standard, swearing isn't very clever. And I was saying that actually swearing is pretty clever and interesting. And in English, we are blessed with lots of good swear words, such as, and actually, you could beat me there, but I'm not going to say them because I'm going to be responsible. Because I was actually I got in trouble on Times Radio for swearing before.
Did you?
Yeah.
What did you say on this show?
Yeah, I said, well, I can't say what I said, but I think you were away And somebody else was in and they had to apologise for me profusely to the audience.
The only time it's happened in this slot was Robert Crampton.
What did Robert Crampton say?
I made a joke about his age. We were talking about, Alice had noted, I think it was when, it must have been when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister, and she said, oh, it was the first time for me that we've had a Prime Minister who's younger than me. And Robert said, oh, no, that's happened to me before. And I said, it was Churchill, wasn't it? And he just went, F off. Quite aggressively into the microphone.
You've got to work out what everybody's little, how you can wind everybody up to make them swear. What what is the way to get them?
Gabby, where do you stand on swearing?
I do it constantly, but unimaginatively, unfortunately, which is basically a function of having worked in newspapers for a long time and started in the very, very, very sweary 1990s. So it's my constant fear when I go on radios. And the minute you start talking about swearing, all I can, and you start thinking, don't swear, does it? You know you're going to do it. But I'm probably not as bad as Dominic Cummings. That's all I can say, judging by the contents of the COVID inquiry.
But I mean, you know, aside, put to one side his politics and his competence and all of that. But for instance, the phrase useless pigs.
Yes, good phrase.
Great
that is the
phrase.
Thick of it come to life.
Yeah.
Which is what we should all desire for our policy. Well, maybe not quite, but it adds a little special sparkle over things, doesn't it?
He gave that to the nation anyway. That was something.
Really artful swearing is...
It's fun. It's silly to say it's not fun because it's obviously funny.
I think the big difference is you don't want to be just aggressive, like telling you to F off.
No.
You can be more artful. Although you wrote that Christopher Hitchens said that you thought that the phrase F off was it the second?
The second greatest gift of the British Empire to the world.
Yeah.
Which is...
What was
pretty
the first?
Football.
Oh, okay.
I mean, those
two things also quite often go hand in hand.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of the British Empire having given any gifts to the world is now probably not very correct. Let alone.
I was going to say, is there some kind of swearing Elgin Marbles trade that we could do here that satisfied everyone? Maybe.
Do other countries swear well?
Well, my thesis in my column, which I actually got in trouble for, was I was saying that English is a satisfying language to swear in because I have lots of good consonants that are satisfying to kind of spit out. And I said, I suppose I can't say Spanish swear words on the radio, but they all sound so beautiful. All these swear words in Spain and France, they all sound like some little patisserie cakes or something.
But German swearing is good, actually. German swearing, well, I learned this mostly from my offspring going on a German exchange visit. And obviously the traditional purpose of a foreign exchange school visit is to learn how to swear in the other person's language. But yeah, German is very, because it kind of bit guttural as well. So you can kind of spit the swear word out quite satisfying.
My argument was that German swearing is almost a bit too sinister because the language is almost too aggressive.
It all sounds like swearing, even when it's
exactly
sausages.
And we've probably all been conditioned by kind of war films and stuff to, you know, interpret it extra negatively.
Well, let's just pause there because we've managed to get through talking about swearing without anyone doing it. So I think we'll call that a success.
Dissecting news of the day, he writes in on his impartial sleigh. Politics without the boring bits.
Let's take a deep dive into policy, kids.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Monday to Friday, 10 till 1. Monday to Friday, 10 till 1.
It's one of my favourites. That's from Bennett, who actually got in touch with the Daily. I think he's been very well, but he's feeling better. I think. So, Bennett, thank you for that. It's one of my favourite of the homemade Christmas jingles. If you want to send us a Christmas jingle, you can email me, matt@times.radio. matt@times.radio. But we're still joined by James Marriott and Gabby Hinsliff. And I wanted to talk now about what happens when politicians meet children. You know, kids say the funniest things, don't they? Downing Street have released a video of a gang of excitable children. I think they're about 5 years old. Just overwhelming Rishi Sunak with questions, and then they end up hugging him. I think it's quite sweet, and I think he handles it quite well. Here they are asking him some tough questions, like whether he's got a pet at home and what he wants for Christmas.
Do you have a pet?
Do I have a pet?
Yeah.
Yes. We have a dog called Nova. Her name is Nova. She's a dog. She's a Labrador.
What do you want for Christmas?
What do I want for Christmas?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I haven't really thought about that, actually. I'd like to have a day off.
What would you like to be when you're little?
When I was little, right, when I was your age. Now, I don't know when I was five what I wanted to be. When I was a bit older, I wanted to be like a Star Wars character, like a Jedi Knight, or fly an X-Wing. Now, have you heard of an X-Wing?
No!
I think it's quite cute, but you've got to think about politicians and when they interact with children. And the sort of person who collects examples of this is James Hill, the political correspondent from The Spectator, who joins us now. Hi, James.
Hi, Matt.
Right, first of all, we'll get to some historic examples in a moment. What did you make of how Rishi Sunak got on with the children?
Well, I think he did all right, given the circumstances. And I'm sure, as we'll discuss, there's plenty of examples of politicians handling it a lot worse. His team obviously want to put him as someone, you know, who's young, energetic, got new ideas. And the Tories can actually talk about education as one of their better track record areas. So it's not surprising he's with these kids all the time in schools. And of course, there was the famous moment last year when he said he was a Coke addict. And then clarified it was Diet Coke he was talking about.
No, it's not Diet Coke, it's Mexican Coke, because it's full...
Oh, Mexican Coke, sorry. Yeah. Yes, of course.
He said, he was speaking to some students and said, I'm a Coke addict, I'm a total Coke addict. And then he had to clarify about it. So here are some other examples. This is Keir Starmer. Not quite getting the kids quite so excited. He barely seems to change his tone when talking to children.
Good morning. You having a nice day?
Is it stressful being an MP?
It's a lovely thing to do, to be a Member of Parliament. Representing everybody in that area is a real privilege. And it's where I live as well. It's where my children go to school, so it means a lot to me to represent my local area. But I did other things first, so I became a lawyer, and then I worked in Northern Ireland, which was incredible. And then I ran the prosecution service in England and Wales. And then eventually, I turned up in Parliament. What do other people want to do?
Do they put that music on it to make it even more soporific? Incredible.
It was sort of strangely emotional.
Yeah. These children. Sorry, how are you spending prosecution service? And then this is Boris Johnson taking a slightly different approach and getting really stuck in.
Oh my God, it's
That's
a worm.
A
it's a huge worm.
Big worm. Massive.
It's a massive worm. We're trying to escape.
Hey.
Get it. Should we get the worm? No, we don't want to kill them.
See, that's quite cute. I think we'll do that. What do you think, Gabby?
Lots of experience with children, of course, Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Very good.
Definitely
very
helps.
Very good. His child-minding. He's in the papers today. Have you seen him? He's in the papers today dressed as Father Christmas with another one of his children. He's up a ladder dressed as Father Christmas, putting the star on the top of the Christmas. Now, the clip that I really wanted to find, because it's one of, and I can't find it anyway, because it's quite old, it's Gordon Brown back in... When was this? It was a long time ago. 2010, I think. Gordon Brown was asked by some children. I think it was on, like, where the children who pretended to be journalists, they sort of went in an interview Gordon Brown. And they asked Gordon Brown, what's your favourite food? And he said, this is a verbatim, traditional things like steak and all that. I love spaghetti bolognese and carbonara and all these things. I like Chinese food. I like Indian food. I like English food, British food and French. I like almost anything. And then the 14-year-old like had to really push him to try and get him to commit to one of them. And he just went back to the beginning and said, I'd like steak. And it's such a good clip, and we can't find it anywhere because it's in that sort of weird bit where, but it's just summed up. Gordon Brown had reached that point where he just couldn't even commit to a food. Everybody asked by a child. Do you think it makes any difference, James Hill, ultimately to a politician's electoral prospects?
Well, it can create the narrative. Of course, the most famous example probably is 2001, where Tony Blair was launching his campaign at the St. Olaf School in Southwark. And what unfortunately happened was that he gave a sort of messianic entrance there. And the sort of singing school children were there. And then he was pictured reading, you know, prayer book, hymn book, with it looking very sort of like a Christ-like figure with a backdrop. And unfortunately, he had this rather soporific way of talking to children as well. And of course, as soon as the press conference was over, all the hacks then rushed to talk to the children. And one of them was quoted in The Times, that great newspaper, as describing it as a pack of lies. And basically, that then set the narrative that Labour were taking it for complacent, that they were trying to politicise, there's too much spin rather than substance. So actually, there are perils with children. Just to say, Matt, quickly, the other great clip of a...
Oh, no, we've lost him. We've lost him with a crucial
moment.
We'll never know.
What is the great clip?
He's just... amazing.
My favourite one is, you know that photo of David Cameron when he's reading with a small child, this nursery visit or something, and he's reading, and the kid is like head down on their book, just on the desk. And it's just like, yeah, that went around the world.
The Boris Johnson photo shoots are great because Boris Johnson basically looks like an oversized child in a primary school class.
Sitting like cross-legged on the floor in a primary school.
And it just looks like he's never left primary school.
Or the one where he played rugby, actually, and took out every small child on the pitch. Do you remember that?
Yes, it was in Japan somewhere. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and, Boris Johnson was never happier than when he was with that child talking about, oh, look at that big worm.
That's what his life should have been. Yeah, the dangerous ones are sixth formers. You never want to talk to sixth formers because they've got political opinions and challenge you.
I think
younger kids are safer, aren't they?
It seemed like a genuinely nice moment for Rishi Sunak and those children, given everything else has been going on. Gabby Hinsliff from The Guardian and James Mowat from The Times. You can read James in The Times of your week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we're going into the British Film Institute's political archive.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
It might feel like politics is constantly evolving, but some things never change. Spin. The British Film Institute has compiled a collection of British political campaigning films and broadcasts spanning more than 100 years. You can take a look at them all yourself. This full spectrum of political promo from the dawn of the 20th century right up to today. It's all on the BFI's website. But today we're going to go through some of the highlights, and here to talk us through them, Patrick Russell, head of the non-fiction team at the BFI at National Archive. Patrick, before we listen to some of your highlights, what makes a good political film for it to be in your archive?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question, Matt. And people might think the BFI National Archive is just about collecting the great feature films or the great television programmes. We do that. But it's actually collecting examples of all the ways that moving image has been used to express ideas and to communicate with people across the 20th and the 21st century. And one of those is party political communication. And as you said, that's a long history. What's really interesting, I think, is even though the political issues change, the economy changes, the particular dynamics of political parties change, the basics have really been the same since certainly the 1930s, if not before, which is you've got these basic forms, drama, documentary, animation, celebrity endorsements, all the things we're familiar with today, those were there in the 1920s and 1930s. And really, I think they're probably primarily trying to do two things. One is galvanize supporters of a political party or political movement to get them to go out there and campaign, or to try to win over skeptics or floating voters. So there's those two basic political situations, I think, into which all those different genres of film kind of land.
I suppose it's interesting because normally if you think of the BFI, people think of, like you said, great films, great TV shows or films that people love or are revered artistically or creatively. There's a sort of different bar to be cleared here. It's not that people love a part of political broadcast and they're quite disposable, you know, because the politicians in them or the messages they're communicating are disposable. You know, it's not like people think, oh, tonight I'm going to sit down and watch a party political broadcast from 1931.
I think the interesting thing is they're ephemeral and timeless at the same time. They're ephemeral, they're absolutely of that moment. So you look at the films from the 1930s, they're about the national government, they're about trade tariffs, they're about recovering from the Great Depression, very different issues from now. But as I say, the basic politics of the situation is the same, and they're meeting kind of timeless communication needs using creativity. So, as you say, not necessarily great fine art, but great applied art.
Yeah.
You know, it's using the moving image medium in order to get across an idea towards members of the public or sections of the public in order to create action, which is ultimately action in the polling booth.
And actually, you know, it goes so far back to the 20s and 30s. We asked you to pick out some of your favourites from the collection. And the first couple were silent cartoons, which, bearing in mind, we're on the radio, to make for brilliant listening. But there's a Conservative and Unionist Film Association was so pleased with their metaphor of Labour-led Britain as a broken-down car in need of a toy MOT. They made not one but two cartoons on the theme in short succession. There's another one. It's great, this, because it's got a sort of cuddly caricature of David Lloyd George in it, this sort of black and white animation. And so it's really interesting that right from the dawn of moving pictures, almost, politicians were trying to get in on the act and weaponize it for their cause.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, that the Conservative Party was probably, so to speak, the most progressive of political parties in terms of catching up with the potential of the film medium. There was a left-wing tradition in political film in the 1930s, but that tended to be outside of the world of party politics, outside of the Labour Party. The Conservative and Unionist Films Association, which you mentioned, was really the first kind of embedding within a political party of an attempt to use the film medium. And the way those films were distributed was basically mobile cinema vans that would turn up in town squares during election campaigns and would project these films in that environment. As you say, some of these were animations. They're basically hand-drawn, line-drawn animations, which use metaphor, you know, the socialist car of state, and also use caricature. Lloyd George, Baldwin, whom they present positively, obviously Ramsay MacDonald. So, you know, right at the dawn of political communication using the film medium, you have animation, caricature, metaphor kind of built into the repertoire of moving image expression for political purposes.
And then a few years later, we do get some sound. So let's jump to 1935. This is a Conservative and Unionist Party election campaign film. This features a debate between a pair of no-nonsense mill workers discussing the merits of safeguarding, or what we now understand to be trade tariffs, to ward off cheap imports. Let's take a listen.
I've been studying this a lot since we've had no work, and this here safeguarding seems to me plain common sense, and chap who stand for it.
Oh, I don't know, Bill. I've always looked upon that sort of stuff as politicians' talk. Here, just really think that what they and the paper say is anything to be guided by?
It isn't what they say.
Interesting you talk about that. It's sort of amateur dramatics in that. You know, it's just politicians talk. You know, this is almost 100 years ago, but the sentiment, if not quite the recording quality, could be something that you'd hear now.
You might suggest this particular film is a piece of sort of Red Wall facing populism, 1930s really style. So the high concept of the film is it's two Lancashire cotton workers discussing these quite arcane issues around trade, protectionism, etc. Whether they're actually Lancashire cotton workers or whether they're RADA trained actors portraying Lancashire cotton workers is a little bit lost to history. But it's again, it's a different technique in the repertoire from the yeah. animation that we discussed, and it's an attempt to try to meet a certain voter base where the political communicators think they can reach them, and it's an attempt to sort of use empathy and aspiration and those sorts of techniques and drama and scripting and acting.
Obviously, it was an unusual election at this period because, you know, the mid-1930s, we had the national government led by Ramsay MacDonald. And this is the popular monologuist, Stanley Holloway. I'm not totally familiar with his work, but you assure me he's popular. Recalling what happened when the comic character Sam Small visited Parliament. This is a film specifically advocating the policies of the national government.
We all ought to listen to Sam, lads. From St. Anne's to St. Stephen's, he's known. He's loyal to duty and country. And he's on speaking terms with the throne. Said Sam, it don't need Nelson's spyglass to see what this government's done. Unemployment, they've brought down 1 million, and they'll try hard to bring it to none. They've tackled the slums and bad housing, and you'll soon be unable to see them, for there won't be a slum in the country. Maybe one in the British Museum.
We'll gloss over the quality of the rhyming in that one.
We shouldn't. it's fine poetry.
Regional accents again. And, you know, nowadays we'd overanalyze a regional accent in a party political broadcast, but presumably the same thing was going on then. The accents and class, you know, was obviously played a much bigger part in that. There's interest in both those films using sort of northern regional accents.
Yeah, so I guess the point is, behind the scenes, however crude they might appear to us today, there's both an element of kind of communications calibration going on in the minds of the people commissioning these films and in the minds of the people producing them. And as I said, you know, the element of celebrity endorsement. Mm. You know, if we think celebrity endorsement of political parties is a 21st century phenomenon, think again. We can see it right there in the 1930s.
It was Stanley Holloway. Let's jump then to the 1940s. In the post-war election, Labour come in under Clement Attlee. In 1948, the Conservative Party had this film trying to show Labour politicians, like the Prime Minister Clement Attlee, as being a sort of stepping stone to a communist state.
Where will the resistance to communism in Britain come from? Will it come from Mr. Bevin and his well-meaning, inexhaustible patience? Will it come from Mr. Attlee, that man of quiet and unhurried reasonableness? Will it come from a party which hesitates to get rid of acknowledged fellow travellers and crypto-communists? No, it will not come from socialism. The real champion against communism is the Conservative Party.
Again, you can hear the production values improving, the music in the background. It sounds like a film of the time.
It's a lot of people would recognise that as having features in common with the newsreel style of the time and the style of public information films of the time. Interestingly, in terms of the sort of emotional political technique, I guess it's connecting back to the animation, the socialist car of state, the fear, like it's playing on a fear element rather than the more friendly approach of the two sound films
I suppose
that we heard.
There were two options. You either big yourself up or do down the other side. And that was very much the latter, that one. In 1959, Tony Benn, lots of people will be familiar with Tony Benn, but before he became an MP, he was a sort of creative spin doctor of his day for the Labour Party. Here he is presenting a Labour Party election campaign, which was actually opened by Hugh Gaitskell, the Labour leader at the time. He talks about, amongst other things, the issue of nuclear disarmament.
Getting rid of all the arms everywhere, so long as it is all the arms everywhere and with proper controls, is surely something we should always welcome and all welcome. If you say, well, it's just propaganda, I would say the best thing then is to test it out. And it'll be exposed if it is propaganda, and if it isn't, then we shall get somewhere.
Obviously, unfortunately, Hugh Gaitskell died before he could become Prime Minister. Well, let's jump down to the 1960s. 1964, this is obviously the election of Alec Douglas Hume, has just replaced Harold Macmillan. Harold Wilson is the coming man. And Jennifer Gay of ATV Today interviewed some school children about politics.
There's Conservative, Liberal, Labour and Communist.
Labour, Convertible, I don't know anyone.
Do you know who the Prime Minister is?
Yes, Sir Halleck Douglas Hume.
And who's the leader of the Labour Party?
Mr. Harold Wilson.
Do you know any of the names of the other political parties?
Yes, Mr. Jorgensen's over the Liberal. And Mr. George Brown is over the Conservative.
If you were 21, who would you vote for?
Conservative.
Why?
Because they don't tax you so much and Prime Minister's the head of it.
How would you vote?
I'd vote for Labour.
Can you tell us why?
Because we break up from school earlier, we went with Labour.
Wow. I mean, they're sewing. I'm not sure if you went to a primary school now and said, who's the... Well, if you went anywhere and said, who's the leader of the Liberal Democrats or the Greens, you'd get those answers. Is that reflective, do you think, of all school children, or is it a particularly uber-engaged group?
I think taking an historical view, sort of moving forward from the stuff we've listened to that piece, obviously the key thing that happens in the post-war period is the coming of television. So you move from those film-based pieces of communication earlier to a world where you both have gate school, addressing the audience in a televisual style, and then, as you say, alongside that, you get the coming of current affairs, political reportage, and this new space that's created, which is kind of a shared space, because there's only a small number of TV channels that everybody watches. It's very different from the world that existed before the war, before television, very different from today's fragmented social media world.
I suppose that's right. You've got a TV in the front room for the first time, but there's only one or two things on it.
Yeah.
So children are watching the news and learning who Mr. Harold Wilson is, because, well, there's nothing else to watch, and there's no, you know, separate screens or whatever.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of children, the following year, 1965, the then newly elected baby of the House, the youngest MP, David Steele, he made it clear what he thought, this is very meta this, what he thought of the party political broadcast TV format during a Liberal Party political broadcast.
Party political broadcasts have always bored me. I've always regretted that you can't even switch over to the other channel because they're on that one too. And they've become so dull of late that attention is no longer paid to what is actually being said. Instead, controversy rages over whether sufficient powder has been applied to the cheekbones of the speaker or whether he shows his teeth when he smiles. And now, after the Roxburgh, Selkirk and Peebles by-election, I find myself taking part in a party political broadcast.
That's sort of undermining the form while using the form. I suppose, again, you know, I'm different. And often, you know, sort of the third party does is sort of we're different. We don't really agree with all this, but we've just got to go along with it.
It's a form of humble bragging, I suppose, isn't it? Self-effacement.
I've never liked these things, but I suppose I better do one now. Yes, Matt Chorley on Times Radio. We are in the BFI National Archive with Patrick Russell, looking at not the films and TV shows that we might expect the British Film Institute to be collecting, but some of the party political broadcasts and films that are part of the collection, many of which won't have been heard or seen since they were first used, you know, during whichever election campaign it was, Patrick.
Yeah, these films were made for their moment. They were made for now, whenever now was. That makes them particularly fascinating to revisit in later years.
So we reach 1967. It's interesting the way that the form of the party political broadcast has changed over the years. Back in the 1960s, the parties had 3 10-minute TV slots to film. I mean, now they're down to sort of 3 or 4 minutes, I think. The Labour Party tried to do something a little bit different. Explain, first of all, before we hear the clip, what is it that the Labour Party tried to do?
Yeah, so this is a very fascinating film. I think it's called Education for the Future. So this was not a party election broadcast, it was a party political broadcast, so it was midterm. And basically, they hired a filmmaker to go out and effectively make a mini documentary about comprehensive education. It hardly even mentions the Labour Party, but instead it uses an observational documentary technique to go into a secondary comprehensive school in Hull and use the experiences that it finds there to present a kind of broad, positive picture of comprehensivisation of education.
I suppose because this is an audience which is becoming more media illiterate. They're familiar with the form of the independent journalistic documentary. So sort of harnessing the cliches, the direction, the narration, to then present a partisan view of what's going on in schools in that way. So let's take a listen. This is Albert Rowe, head teacher at David Lister High School in Kingston upon Hull. It was the filmmaker Derek Knight made this. But here is the head teacher, Albert Rowe, talking about those benefits of comprehensive education.
Well, a comprehensive school is about educating everybody. It's about the individual pupil. It sets out to give each pupil the greatest possible equality of educational opportunity. And I hasten to say here, the greatest possible equal opportunity to be different, to prove that we are unequal.
There's a subtlety and a quality to that film that I think is both of merit in its own right, but also helps to make it effective as a piece of kind of political education in the broad sense, sort of trying to inform the wider public view of the political environment in which policy changes are being implemented.
And not saying so crassly, therefore vote Labour, but just wanting people to think, I saw a thing on the TV last night, our schools are doing quite well, aren't they? And just lodging that as a seed. Like you said, it's midterm, so it's not trying to push people into making a decision about voting, but reinforcing the idea under the Labour government.
It's kind of providing nutrition into the kind of information ecosystem, I suppose, in a way.
Really fascinating that. This one I love. So this isn't a party political broadcast. This is The Clangers. Now, listeners of a certain age will be familiar with this. The pink knitted creatures, they live on a little blue planet. So they put out an episode coinciding with the general election in 1974. Now, the Clangers aren't taken with the prospect of a society ruled by one group, even though the soup dragon stands for an election on a free soup for all ticket.
Soup must be paid for. Hey, but what with? I mean, you don't have any money. Free soup for all. Yes, that should catch the votes. No soup for froglets. Dear me, you do learn fast. Now, wait a minute. Wait. We must hear from the froglet. Now, froglet, what is your policy? Well, that's just rude. Whatever the soup dragon wants, he is against it. Right. Now, who is going to support the froglet? There. Now you are a political party.
I love that. As a satire of politics, even today. What's your policy? Whatever he's not doing.
There seem to be some tax and spend debates going on there.
As well. And
I think there were two 1974 general elections, weren't there? So it was a politically febrile time.
Absolutely, yeah. A Conservative Prime Minister up against high inflation, high energy bills, going to the country and it not working out. I can't imagine how that might work. Exactly 50 years it'll be next year. So let's hear now about some of the sort of things that might end up in the archive in the future. And first of all, this is a Tory campaign video from 2019.
Your vote matters. With your vote, you decide. Do you stop the arguing or let it carry on? End the argument. Stop the chaos. Vote Conservative. Get Brexit done. Get all of this done. And move on.
The thing that struck me about that is having obviously reported on and covered that election, I didn't remember that ad at all. And maybe you're right, the personalisation, the segmentation, you know, just the amount of stuff that gets pumped out now, you know, it's easy to miss them. And in the interest of balance, here is one from Labour from 2019 as well.
Dementia tax, gone. Millions losing their winter fuel allowance, gone. Fox hunting ban, gone.
In a YouGov poll of this morning, the Conservatives on 48% of the vote, Labour on half that.
We, the media, the pundits, the experts, know nothing.
We did the biggest campaign growth since polling began.
So there's a Labour message there, again sort of trying to drum up the, repeating the excitement of 2017. Both of them using, you know, strong voices, music, actually all sort of in keeping with the media language that we're familiar with right now. Patrick Russell, just finally, it's interesting where those two final clips fit into this grand sweep of basically 100 years of political video.
Yeah, I think fascinating. I think those are both two very strong pieces, looking at them from a kind of filmmaking and a communications perspective. And they illustrate those two kind of different uses of film. The Conservative one is trying to win over potential floating voters. The Labour one, I think it was basically their social media launch video, is galvanising their supporters to go out and campaign. So the Labour video, obviously you've heard the sounds, you haven't seen the pictures, people can find those online. But the Labour one, it has a very kind of infectious, propulsive, very well crafted, edited, forward sweep to it that pulls the viewer along into wanting to go out and campaign. The Conservative piece has more of a sort of pantomime style in a way. So the pictures that go with the sound that you've heard is very much a kind of stage scenario of kind of characters playing politicians, arguing in front of a kind of a black screen, representing the quandary which the party is proposing that they solve. It's the basically get Brexit done argument, you know. And obviously both of those parties then pursued both of these different strategies in different ways across the campaign, but both like very, very strong thought through pieces of campaigning film, both of which like directly exactly everything that was happening in the 1930s. Win over your skeptics and your floating voters, galvanize your supporters. You've got drama, you've got documentary, you've got animation, and use filmmaking style to achieve a result. That, I think, however much the world of politics changes over the next 100 years, I think that will still remain the essence of political party film in the years to come. And people, just to say, people can catch all of this stuff that we've got in our collection. It's called Never Mind the Ballots.
Very good.
And it's available on the BFI player, along with many, many, many hundreds of other films from the BFI National Archive that are available for you to the available free to the whole public.
Well, Patrick, it's absolutely fascinating. I've spent far too long trawling through the archive because it's, I think I'll just watch one more. What's so fascinating is the way that the characters might change, the message might change because the policies change, but the form and the way that political parties, again and again and again, whether it's silent animation to, you know, directly speaking to viewers, to the use of music, the use of voiceovers, now the use of sort of social media techniques, reflecting our times all the time as well. It's absolutely fascinating.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly right. Patrick Russell from the British Film Institute's National Archive, the non-fiction team there. Thanks very much for joining us on Times Radio.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget, if you're a Time subscriber, link your Time subscription to your Apple account, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, you can get a bonus episode every Saturday. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/bonus podcasts. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.